second case for oral argument this morning is Fiska Engineering Appellant versus SPM Thermal Shield, Inc. Appellee. For the appellant is Mr. Michael Luce, an attorney from Rapid City, and for the appellee, Mr. Gerald Baldwin, an attorney from Custer. Mr. Luce, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. I am Mike Lose, and I'm here today representing Fiska Engineering, the appellant in this case. In today's society, very important matters are being, disputes are being resolved through the mechanism of arbitration. One of the presumed benefits of arbitration is that it relieves the courts and the judicial system from resolving each and every dispute that arises in society. But along with the benefits of arbitration to the judiciary process comes a responsibility to at least assure that there is fairness in the procedure itself. For when livelihoods and life savings are on the line, it is important that the participants in society have faith that their disputes will be resolved in a fair manner and in accordance with our view of justice. Almost 18 months ago, I petitioned for review to this case, and the issue at that time was whether or not an arbitration award in favor of the defendant in this case was procured by undue means.
Did you petition to the arbitrator or to the circuit court?
To the circuit court, Your Honor. To the circuit court. As a matter of procedure, the initial pleading was with the circuit court in Rapid City. Under the statute that allows for relief from arbitration awards for a variety of factors, in this case, the subsection referring to fraud and undue means as set forth in the statute. That's SDCL 21-25A-24 sub 1. Following the circuit court's denial of our petition, my client sought review before this court. The critical issue was whether or not the refusal to provide documents in the course of the arbitration gave rise to an award that was procured by undue means. The discovery of additional documents, motions, a remand, an additional hearing before the trial court brings us here today, where the issue again remains, is the failure to produce documents within the context of an arbitration proceeding sufficient to vacate the award under the category of undue means.
Now, were some of those documents not viewed by the trial court?
The majority of the documents that are now part of the Supreme Court record were not reviewed by the trial court. And just to be specific, there are, to give the court a time reference, the agreement between the parties was terminated on September 15, 2000. What we have discovered in the course of the appeal, actually, are two memoranda of understanding dated September 1st, 2000. Those documents were not available before the trial court, other than upon this court's remand and request that the trial court make the decision about supplementing our appellate record.
But when the trial court supplemented it, he did not review his original decision then in light of these new documents.
No, Your Honor. I think the trial court deferred to this court in terms of the significance of the new documents. And I think that's consistent with the standard of review in this case, which seemingly is a pass-through standard. The trial court and this court review on the same standard of review. Review of arbitration awards is limited, but if sufficient statutory grounds exist, the party seeking review bears the burden of showing an error on the record. So the trial court did not have the September 1st, 2000 memoranda of understanding. The record will show that a week following these two agreements, the defendant in this case sought a change to the party's agreements, and then when that change was rejected by my client, terminated the contract then 3 days later. So the trial court had, at the time it ruled on the merits, a single document, which was a December 3rd, 2000 agreement between the defendant and a German corporation that talked about distribution rights of the products at issue in this case. So this court is really the first body that's going to have a chance to review everything that's been discovered since the arbitration to make the ultimate decision, was this a fair arbitration?
Should we be making that, or should we be sending it back to Judge Tice to make that decision?
Your Honor, I believe this court is the body that needs to make that decision, and for this reason. The standard of review, as I mentioned, appears to be the same here as it is at the trial court. That is my burden to show an error on the record and to first, of course, identify a statutory ground to have the arbitration award vacated. Because without that, I think everybody would concede there is no review of, you can't, for example, review for insufficiency of evidence a decision in arbitration. That's not allowed. What you can do, and what is the responsibility of the courts, is to ensure that the process was fair. The grounds that are listed in Section 24 are exclusive, other than the undue means, which I believe to be a catch-all for or just simply a function of we're not able to identify every possible reason a party might gain an unfair advantage in the course of an arbitration. The Foy case, Your Honor.
If we determined that there were undue means or that a fair decision hadn't been reached, that we reached that level, what's that, a preponderance of the evidence? We have to decide that say, a fair decision wasn't reached?
I think that it's preponderance of the evidence by default. In other words, the ASCON construction case, the Foy case, some of the handful of South Dakota Supreme Court's decisions reviewing arbitrations don't set forth a different standard. In other words,
all right,
clear and convincing.
Assuming that's right, then why would we send it back to the trial court other than as a conduit? Why wouldn't we send it back to the circuit court to send it back to the arbitration court to determine once again on the merits whether or not that has any effect?
That's interesting, and I would agree with you that I think that is the proper procedure. Your Honor, I think the proper, if the court finds that the award was procured by undue means, I think the statute set forth that the remedy is you either send it back to arbitrators as set forth in the contract, or you send it back to the arbitrators as decided by the trial court. Now, what would then be in front of the arbitrators raises an interesting question. It's my understanding that it would be a completely new arbitration, not unlike a new trial, on the merits of was there proper cause to terminate the contracts. That's what the arbitration was all about. The parties had agreements that only allowed for termination in the instance of good cause. And so that's, I think, what needs to go back to the arbitrator. Was there good cause, given what we know now about the history of dealings between the defendant and some of the plaintiff's competitors?
The issue, then, of undue means is actually needs to be determined by the trial court or this court, is what you're saying, and the arbitrator would not make that decision. That's a legal issue, or that is a factual legal issue that must be determined by the court. Is that your
That is position? My understanding, Your Honor, and to put a finer point on it, I do believe it is this body that needs to decide undue means based on the record.
Okay, following up on that then, the trial to the trial court was to determine that issue, wasn't it?
Correct.
The undue means. In that process, there was testimony presented, and there was live testimony, isn't that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so there were factual findings made by the trial court, as well as some credibility issues, I'm assuming, because people testified. So wouldn't it be appropriate for us to send this back in light of the fact that the trial court heard the testimony and heard the witnesses and now would need to take all of that into consideration in addition to these new documents?
I guess the short answer, Your Honor, from my position would be no, that's not necessary, given the fact that as a matter of judicial economy or efficiency, this court will review the same documents as the trial court under the same standard of review. And now that the documents are now complete, the record is complete, that there's no reason for the trial court to make a decision that ultimately this body can make. And I'm not so sure that it is credibility issues as much as it is being able to look at the documents and derive from that the legal question of was the arbitration award procured by
undue means. The trial court did make a finding that they had not intentionally held these documents back. And that would certainly be a finding that the trial court would have made based on the testimony and the information the trial court had in place.
I would agree, Your Honor. I would, with the caveat, say that I'm not so sure that a party needs to show a malicious component to the failure to produce documents as opposed to inadvertence or negligent failure to produce documents. This is a unique case for this reason. As many of you probably know, there is typically no discovery in an arbitration dispute, but in this particular case there was. So I think that distinguishes this case from really several published opinions that talk about the idea that you didn't have evidence at arbitration is almost sort of tough luck. You bargained for that kind of a dispute resolution knowing that it's not the judicial system. But in this case, there was a specific directive by the arbitrator that these documents should be produced, that they were to be produced, and that it was in line with a briefing schedule that the arbitrator set forth at the conclusion of the arbitration.
But that document, actually, the trial court had. Isn't that correct?
Well, I don't want to quibble. The arbitrator said, you must produce the contract with the Germans, okay? I think it's subject to debate what that means, but I think it was incumbent upon the defendant, given something of an ambiguity. So what we've got is two memoranda of understanding and then two agreements that come some 6 weeks later. And so when you're directed by the arbitrator to produce the contract with the Germans, I think it is your burden to err on the side of disclosure. And the defendant wasn't just selective in what it produced. It didn't produce anything. And so when it was asked to produce the contract with the Germans, a subject matter I would remind the court that was in dispute at the arbitration, there was the defendant, the president of the defendant, was exceptionally difficult to pin down about what agreements were out there and the timing of these agreements. And so it was less than clear that there was an agreement. And so on the arbitrator's briefing schedule, when the documents weren't produced, the briefs had to come in, and the case was decided without opinions, as is the arbitrator's right. So the trial court had a document that was arguably responsive to the arbitrator's directive that the contract with the Germans be produced. We now know there certainly were more, and maybe it's important to remind the court. I mean, the issue in this case is was the arbitration award procured by undue means? But it's our burden to show not just that, but that it would have made a difference, okay? There's a causation element that I think is mentioned in the Foy case. In other words, if the information that you're complaining about was already sort of out there for the arbitrator to consider, then I don't think you can prevail in this circumstance. In terms of the importance of the September 1st, 2000 agreements, they're critical on this issue because one of them promises manufacturing rights that were already granted to my client. The other refers to my client's territory and the idea that they should be convinced to be subsumed by this new German corporation and have become part of their franchise. And so the court needs to consider that the issue in front of the arbitrator was there just cause to terminate this contract? And without the documents that preceded the termination, the attorney who did the arbitration, their hands were severely tied. And one can imagine how important the cross-examination would have been had these documents been available. Just to remind the court of the timeline, we've got memorandum of understanding executed a week before the defendant solicits a change to the contract and 2 weeks before the contracts are terminated. These documents, the September 1st, don't talk about terminating my client's territories. And they certainly reference that business would continue as usual. You would become part of the German company's franchise. I think that's very powerful evidence when your position in arbitration is there was not just cause to terminate this contract. Everything you said in your termination letter is belied by the fact that you wanted to continue doing business 2 weeks before the contract was terminated. You just wanted us to be part of the German company's franchise. And maybe more importantly, the reason you terminate the manufacturing agreement is because it's already promised to another party 2 days later. So was there just cause or was there really a necessity on the part of the defendant to terminate these agreements based on promises made earlier? This documentation not being available, that cross-examination was completely unavailable to the plaintiff. And if this was just a case of, you chose arbitration and so the discovery rules are sort of lax, I don't think we could win. But that's not the case. These documents, first of all, there was pre-arbitration hearing discovery where, among other things, the defendant was asked, had you already promised the manufacturing rights in 2000 prior to terminating? And the answer was no. There was questions about it during the arbitration, and the answer was no. But then the arbitrator ended all doubt about whether we can just sort of pass this off as, oh, it's just arbitration, by demanding that the agreements be produced.
Before you run out of time, I don't have all the record with me on the bench this morning. Are there findings of fact in addition to the letter decision of Judge Tice?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, so those are essentially the findings.
That was the entirety of the court's decision.
And that letter doesn't really indicate who testified.
If the question is who testified, it was the principals of the two parties. The president of Spiska Engineering, the plaintiff, as well as his son, and then the president of the defendant.
And I presume this testimony related to would this have made a difference before the administrator?
Yeah, the testimony was in the way of some background information about the party's relationship, and then what did you know at arbitration, and what significance was there in, at that time, Your Honor, just this agreement that post-dates the termination. And of course, the trial court correctly observed, hey, plaintiff, you're seeking to vacate this arbitration, but you can't show any contracts that predate the termination. And at that time, that was true.
Okay, but still, don't you have a determination there by the trial court as to the credibility of the president and the son and the president of the defendant, so that with these new documents, doesn't he have to redetermine his decision as to whether or not there's undue means or sufficient cause there to send it back to the arbitrator or not? Isn't that a step that we would have to make if we go your route?
As my time's running out, I would, in short answer, say no, and I hope not, and I hope to explain more on rebuttal, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Baldwin, 20 minutes, sir.
Good morning. I'm Jerry Baldwin from Custer, and I represent the appellee in this matter, ThermoShield. It's the proper name is SPM ThermoShield. ThermoShield is a company that is resident in Custer and is engaged in the marketing of a coating product, a roof coating product entitled ThermoShield, and this company markets this product worldwide. In the course of marketing this product, it establishes dealerships around the world, and this is where the parties became involved in 1994 when Mr. Spiska, the appellant, was granted a dealership for a certain territory in Europe. As things progressed, this contract was expanded to include additional territories and also expanded to include manufacturing rights. The manufacturing of this product was done in the United States, marketed to these various countries in Europe, and ultimately sold to consumers there. It's important to note that prior to engaging in business in any country, it was necessary to obtain certification from that country before a product could be marketed. And Mr. Spiska began his marketing efforts in Czechoslovakia and the Czech Republic, and had some success starting in 1994. In 1995, he sold $226,000 worth of product, in 96, $116,000, 97, $122,000, and in the early months of 1998, he sold $44,000 worth of product in those countries. This issue came to a head over the country of Poland, and it's significant to note that none of the sales that Mr. Spiska ever had were in the country of Poland, and he never obtained certification in Poland. Also, he never has ever engaged in the manufacturing end of his franchise. So just as a background of this matter, there were no sales by Mr. Spiska for 2.5 years prior to the termination. One of the statements that counsel has just made is that the termination was only affected in 2001, when part of the evidence included a letter, which is attached to my brief as exhibit number one, which was a letter from Mr. Spiska stating that he could no longer pursue all of the territories that he had and wished to withdraw to the countries of the Czech and the Czech Republic and one other country, and was not able to proceed forward with Poland and France and the other countries that he had had franchises for. This piece of evidence was disputed, and Mr. Spiska in his testimony twice admitted that it was his signature on this letter, but continued to say that he did not sign it, whatever that meant. But in any event, that evidence was before the arbitrator. It was also brought to the circuit court in the motion before the circuit court to set aside the judgment of the arbitrator.
Is the franchise terminated not only to Poland or France, but also to Czechoslovakia?
The ultimate termination did, the one in 2000. But the release that we claimed, which was released in a letter from Mr. Spiska to ThermoShield, that was done in 1998. So in any event, I think the significance of that particular document is not only whether or not Mr. Spiska denies that it was sent or whether it was accepted or not. The fact was brought before the arbitrator that the franchise was being concluded. The second exhibit in my brief is a response from ThermoShield advising in 1998 that new representation would be found for the countries that Mr. Spiska was releasing. So that knowledge was before the arbitrator early on. The matter of the testimony before the arbitrator and the failure to produce those documents, that occurred in a very brief portion of an extensive arbitration. This arbitration was scheduled to last a day. It ended up lasting 4 days, most of the time in about 10-hour days. Most of the arbitration involved the actions of Mr. Spiska, his failure to develop his territories, his failure to sell the products, his failure to cooperate with ThermoShield in developing these territories. And this was only an incidental matter. The neglect to produce these documents stands before you. Mr. Lewes was not involved in this arbitration. Another attorney was there. As it happened to me many times in depositions where matters come up and you agree to produce documents later on. And I agreed to that. The arbitrator said, produce those. And it was not done. In the conclusion of the record before the arbitrator, the arbitrator certainly appears to have forgotten that he asked for the documents. I forgot that we offered to produce the documents. And the counsel for the appellant certainly made no objection to concluding the record without having those documents.
Now, is this all before the circuit court?
Yes.
What you're saying here today?
Yes, it is. And once again, I believe that the significance of these documents, the fact that it all boils down to the simple fact that that ThermoShield was negotiating with someone else to take over these territories. The claim of appellant is that although he had claimed the foundation for this termination to be this non-performance, that in truth we had a secret agenda and a clandestine plan to take this territory from the appellant and give it to someone else. The fact that the territory was being given to someone else only follows naturally that if Mr. Spiska and the appellant's company was not able to perform, was not selling the product, that if it were terminated, obviously that the ThermoShield company would seek new and better distribution of its product. And this fact was brought to the arbitrator in several matters of testimony. The fact that there were these contracts out there, just by the line of testimony that's provided to you in appellant's brief, lets the arbitrator certainly know that those documents did exist, and the fact of these negotiations with new replacement representation was going on.
How much information was there before the arbitrator on that issue about the prior negotiations?
It was limited. It was limited.
Was it denied by your client?
No. I tell you that the reason that it was not produced was, again, my neglect in doing so. It was just forgotten, and in the grand scheme of things, it seemed to be a minor matter. It was not something that we really were prepared to discuss in arbitration. The focus of the arbitration was the grounds for termination, not what happened to the franchise after it was terminated.
How would you define undue means?
Well, I think short of fraud, apparently, is the intent of that, Your Honor. I believe that if there is a grounds for undue means, it's something underhanded, something devious. The cases that were cited were like improper contacts or fraternalization with the arbitrator, some behind-the-scenes manipulation. I didn't see any cases that undue means involved just lack of evidence. The difference in the court had inquired about how much was seen by the circuit judge on review, and what was not in the circuit court's hands was the actual documents. And again, there was no demand. It has always been allowed and admitted consistently that a new representative would be found, and that matter was the basis of the motion in front of the circuit judge. The documents, having the actual documents in hand, added nothing more to the claim. It could be no stronger than to claim that there were these negotiations with or without the actual document. And having now produced the actual documents does not add anything new or different to the issue. The issue being, were you in fact negotiating, was ThermoShield negotiating with someone else to take over these territories when they were terminated from the appellant? That issue was clearly in front of the circuit court.
What was the exact issue of the arbitrator? Was there more than one issue, or was it just whether or not they had reason to terminate the contract?
I believe that the issue was simply boiled down to that, whether there was cause to terminate the contract. And in that light, it should be noted that the contract, and the contract was clearly negotiated. The appellant admitted that he had an attorney in negotiating this contract. And that contract, the standard of performance in that contract, was that the appellant was obligated to perform to the satisfaction of ThermoShield. That's the terms the contract is included in the appendix in my brief. That is a standard of performance. There is not any requirement for due cause. It's as arbitrary as to ThermoShield's satisfaction. And
so, arbitrary, it didn't have to be a reasonable satisfaction.
I'm sorry?
It's measured subjectively by ThermoShield. It's not an objective or a reasonable satisfaction.
Well, I guess implied in that, yes, there might be some basis that it needed to be reasonable, and we allowed that and defended on that basis. And I guess the question is, what standard, however, is imputed into the contract? Does it need to be reasonable or need it to be arbitrary? But the record was replete with evidence of non-performance by the appellant. And it also includes the disputed testimony that he had relinquished a number of these territories. The actual contracts, and I guess there's some confusion about which actually accomplished the termination of the contract, whether they were released earlier, and in the mind of ThermoShield, they believed that the only contracts remaining that Spiska, by his letter that was received in evidence, he wished to retain, were the countries of the Czech Republic, and I forgot the other country, but Ukraine. And those were where he had had his success, where he was certified. And in the termination, there was correspondence which is which counsel has suggested was showing some ulterior motive, either you do this or we'll terminate. The only reason of this correspondence, again, it was considered only in effect for those countries that ThermoShield considered still had a valid franchise, or that Spiska still had a valid franchise, those three countries, and that was an effort to bring it into line with the pricing for the other distributorships in the country, and there was little to be gained by applying that. The decision to terminate was simply based on the fact of non-performance.
Now, if the arbitrator would have made the decision against your client and said that there wasn't reason to terminate, what would have been the result? Did he consider damages then, or would it actually have been a specific performance?
The contract, again, which is in the brief, the contract provides that in the event of termination, neither party can claim damages. Again, the record before this court is rather minimal. I do believe it's appropriately before the court. I believe that there is nothing new or different by having submitted the actual contracts, which I stipulated to put before the court. There is nothing new or different other than the issues presented in front of the circuit court. And in his memorandum opinion, the Judge Tice directly addressed that issue. And he said in his finding that for defendant to actively seek alternative distributors to the plaintiff was an exercise of reasonable and expected business practice. And I believe that is a direct finding in regard to the issue of did ThermoShield go out? Was that their motive? Was it an ulterior motive? Did this fact, had it been known to the arbitrator, which it was, had the actual contracts been there, produce nothing new or different than was actually shown in arbitration? As the cases have cited, there is no review of arbitration, no appeal, that is, of arbitration. It is, as counsel has pointed out, an important thing, and the parties to this agreement had been bound to conduct this arbitration, and they were bound to be held by the results of that arbitration, and the law provides no appeal of that. And I do not believe that the fact of these contracts rises to the level of showing that there was some totally hidden, unknown agenda, that there were facts unknown to the arbitrator or to the circuit court about the negotiations for a new distributor that would have changed the finding of the arbitrator and the substantial evidence of the non-performance of the appellant in this contract, which gave rise to a termination for a cause.
And why would Judge Tice have found it significant enough to specifically find that there was no evidence that any contract of any kind was entered into with the German corporation prior to the time that they contracted with the German corporations?
Because
I found that significant in here.
I believe that is true, and it remains true, Your Honor. And there is some dispute. There are memorandums in the supplemental information that you have. There are memorandum decisions which we allege memorandums are an indication of an intent to enter a contract. In one of the memorandums, it alludes to the remaining contract rights of Mr. Spiska, and the actual date of the effective contract was the last document. And the memorandum certainly is an indication of an intent, but it alludes to the remaining contracts, and it post-dates the termination of the contract. So our position remains that no actual contract was executed until after appellant's rights were fully terminated.
Okay. Are you completed your presentation?
Excuse me?
Are you done?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. No penalty for quitting early. Mr. Lewis, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I think it's overstated to say that there was nothing new that was presented by virtue of the documents that were discovered after the arbitration. The documents that predate the termination that Mr. Baldwin concluded his presentation discussing were very much new information in terms of substance and detail, and maybe most importantly, timing, because that there was great doubt cast in the testimony of the defendant's president about the nature of its negotiations with third parties. And certainly it's not the burden of a party seeking relief from an arbitration to show some vast conspiracy or something of that nature. We're seeking review on the grounds of, was this arbitration fair? The issue before the arbitrator, and Your Honor's question was there a question of damages that was in front of the arbitrator? And certainly there was. And the contract says, when our contracts are terminated, neither party is going to be entitled to damages. Well, that certainly is a far cry from saying if one party is found to have wrongfully terminated the contracts, it's absurd to say that you're foreclosed from pursuing damages. I mean, in a standard termination provision, the contract says when they're terminated, there's no damages. Well, the whole issue is, was there a wrongful termination here? So I think maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves, but the issue of damages was in front of the arbitrator. And the question was there proper grounds to terminate the contract?
Was there any evidence before the arbitrator of damages?
Yes. Yeah, pretty substantial evidence, as I understand it, in terms of sort of the capital contributions that preceded the termination, the sales, the marketing efforts, and sort of your standard projections about profits and whatnot. That was all presented by way of testimony and exhibits.
Your Honor. Is your company still claiming that they should, even though they weren't certified, say, as to Czechoslovakia, that they want the franchise for that country?
Your Honor, the Spiska Engineering, Inc. remains an active Colorado corporation. In the 4 years, 3 years since the termination, the sales network has, for obvious reasons, gone dormant. I think if this court would remand the case to the trial court for further remand for re-arbitration, the primary issue in front of the arbitrator would be damages. I think it would be an extraordinary endeavor to come up to speed in the European markets. And just so we're clear, there was certification for the distribution of the product in Czechoslovakia. Some of the other territories, that process was ongoing.
Is that in the record, the certification for Czechoslovakia?
Yes, I think that would be stipulated too, that the purchases that my client made and the sales that were made were based on certifications in Czechoslovakia. That's the president of the plaintiff is was born in Czechoslovakia. That's his home country. He lives in Denver now, but that was an area that where they started their efforts.
Well, Mr. Baldwin says you never got certification from Czechoslovakia.
I understood him to say.
You never made any sales there.
I understood him to say that there wasn't, and there's good reason for confusion. I understood him to say that there was no certification in Poland and some of the other territories.
Okay, maybe I had the countries.
There are a number of countries that were addenda to the contract, and so.
Yeah, you're right. He said that never obtained certification from Poland, so.
And that is true.
So going back to my initial question, you know, are you still seeking a franchise with Poland, a country you never obtained certification with?
I would highly doubt it, Your Honor. I think it would be an extraordinary endeavor to displace the network that's been put into place by the defendant and its agents, and then come up to speed on the part of my client. Although, once the product is certified, I think it's certified as to all distributors, so perhaps part of the upfront difficulty would be alleviated. They're not foreclosing any options, but I would suspect that the primary issue, if this matter is re-arbitrated, would be what damages attend the wrongful termination.
Can you just explain how these documents, how would we be able to determine whether these documents constitute undue means that procured the decision of the arbitrator? To procure is the issue that I am confused about.
And I,
because if the information, as Mr. Baldwin said, was overwhelming that your client had not lived up to the terms of the agreement, then how would we make the determination that these documents procured that arbitrator's decision by undue means?
And I guess preliminarily I'd dispute his premise that the information was overwhelming. I think the merits of the underlying dispute were, I would say, fought to a bit of a draw. And I don't know that this court needs to challenge itself with that kind of an analysis of the record, other than to say the very unique nature of the review is to determine, was it fair? Was the process fair? And in answer to that question, was it procured by undue means, I would merely submit that certainly the Foy case says that where, you know, significant information is withheld by the arbitrator, and I presume the same would be true if an information is withheld by a party, that can be grounds to vacate. We cite the Chevron Transport case for the proposition that a party's unwillingness to turn over a document can be grounds to vacate an arbitration. And in this particular case, I think that the point is made when we consider what was at issue. That is, was the termination wrongful? And so when you have documents withheld that would have greatly aided both the cross-examination of the defendant's president and the presentation of our case in chief, there's where you make the link. It was unfair. I think the documents speak to themselves, and Justice Sabers, your question about, you know, what would be a proper remand, I think the Ascon Construction versus Golden Hills case makes clear that the burden on appeal is the same as it is below, that the party asserting error has the burden to show by the record that error has been committed. I don't believe there's necessarily a credibility issue here. I think these documents speak for themselves, and it's for this court to determine whether, given what we know would have been available in terms of cross-examination and presentation of our case, was the agreement fair. Again, we've got agreements that talk about continuing the relationship of the parties 2 weeks before the termination, and there's no reference whatsoever to overwhelming evidence that my client has not lived up to its end of the bargain. Quite the opposite is true. The documents that weren't available speak to a continuation of the business relationship. And so I think that's how we make the link. It simply wasn't fair because those would have been powerful tools to support our case. Not that there was some vast conspiracy against our client, but that you didn't have proper grounds to terminate. You terminated because you'd already committed our manufacturing rights to another party. And you terminated because we didn't agree to an increase in prices that would have been 30% higher than what we're paying now. So, you know, the issue was fairly simple, and to say that our burden is to prove some greater wrongdoing isn't necessarily the case. And I'm sensitive to Mr. Baldwin's position in terms of, and sometimes these things can be overlooked, but that doesn't excuse the fact that they were ordered them to be produced. And then when additional information became available, specifically, things started pointing to these earlier agreements, these September 1st, 2000 agreements. And Mr. Baldwin's client still failed to come clean about those and directed that his attorney say there are no contracts of any nature that, you know, predate the termination. That's a strong statement to make in terms of a distinguishment between memorandum of understanding and contract. As my time is expiring, I'd like to thank the court for its time on behalf of myself and my client and urge that a remand be issued and redirect for another arbitration.
Thank you, counsel. Court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.